Our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It's a free download and you can go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. That's firmsconsulting with an S.com/overall approach. And if you're looking to advance your career and need to update your resume, you can get a McKinsey and BCG winning resume template as a free download at www.firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. That's www.firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. Hey, Jeremy, great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Excellent. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
As a starting point, where are you joining us from today?
I'm in La Honda, California, just up the Santa Cruz Mountains from Stanford University.
Oh, that's a nice area. How's the weather?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's been windy here. It's been rainy, but it's starting to clear up. We're starting to get the new buds of spring. So I'm delighted to see the sunlight coming through.
I was going to ask you about the property prices, but given it's San Francisco, it's probably pretty scary.
It's not the most affordable of locations.
Not the most affordable. Exactly. Anyway, we have a lot to discuss. Lots of things happening in the world of AI. Let's start with the most obvious thing I'm seeing and your research is showing as well, right? So I was talking with my teams earlier today to understand how they are using certain AI tools like Perplexity and so on. And one thing I noticed is they're expecting the tool to give them the complete unabridged answer. And if they don't get the answer, they move on and say AI doesn't work for them, which can't be the case, right?
Right, right.
So you're also seeing that with your research?
There's a profound tendency with human beings to what Herbert Simon in 1954 called satisfice, which is just settle on the best available answer as quickly as possible. And it's cognitive bias that's long been established in the literature and in practice. The interesting thing about generative AI, while it has the potential to enormously boost the volume of potential solutions we identify, yet in practice, what our research identified is that often instead of mitigating the bias, generative AI actually just amplified the bias, which is to say it got teams to good enough much more quickly. And as you observed, even with your team, they just move on. Rather than pushing for the best result, they just move on.
I also was speaking to the head of, what's the title she had? I think it was the head of research or head of internal knowledge management at a major consulting firm. And this senior partner was telling me that when they rolled out AI, they expected to have more creative solutions and more depth in research. But what they found is that teams wanted the quickest answer.
Yeah.
And they went with the quickest answer, even if it was not the best answer. And they found the quality of the consulting advisory work actually decreased in the year when they rolled out their internal AI tools. Now, these are obviously smart people, right? These guys have MBAs from Stanford, Harvard, Wharton, and so on. These are intelligent people. So if the most intelligent people are struggling to use AI, what do you think would be the behavior modification that needs to be in place to make the most use of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that really accords with what we found in our research as well, that teams that treat AI like an oracle, like it's an all-knowing entity, it feels like magic for those teams. They think, wow, we got great output so quickly.
Exactly.
And then in the end, they end up actually underperforming. The teams that outperform, they treat AI differently. Instead of approaching AI like an oracle, which feels magical, they approach AI like a thought partner, which actually feels like work. And so it's not as rewarding, and yet they do end up getting to better outcomes. So I think the challenge is, how do folks shift their perception of the technology from kind of an answer giver to a thought partner? And if you treat generative AI much more like a person, I realize there's some danger in anthropomorphizing generative AI, but if you treat AI more like a person and push back and critique and second guess, you're way more likely to get to spectacular outcomes. And there are some simple, very, very simple things that people can do to dramatically bend the outcome curve in their favor.
What would be some of those things they could do?
So we lay it out in our paper. We call it the Fixit model, F-I-X-I-T. You can go to howtofixit.ai and you can find our write-up.
I like that.
But we say collaboration with AI is broken. Here's how to fix it. So that's hence howtofixit.ai. But how to fix it, very simply, F, set a focused problem. I, ideate as an individual before going to AI. X, provide the AI sufficient context. I, interact iteratively. And then T, team-based incubation and next steps for experimentation. If a team will leverage this approach, they're far more likely to short-circuit some of the cognitive biases that we observed, and they're far more likely to identify better solutions. But here's something even simpler. What probably 90% of listeners or 90% of users don't even realize is there, the most important thing on a ChatGPT screen is actually the little regenerate button.
To iterate.
Basically, what we know is the cost historically, long history, the cost of another solution has been high. That's why, from a biological perspective, it's why satisficing, as Herbert Simon put it, or Einstelling, as Abraham Lutyens put it back in the 1940s, that's why this cognitive bias exists, because it's expensive to generate more ideas in terms of caloric input, right? Well, all of a sudden we have an indefatigable intellectual sparring partner, right? And just like you sit at the blackjack table and you can say, hit me, right? Now with ChatGPT and other LLMs, all you have to do is hit that regenerate button. And I would say for any team, bare minimum best practice, not even best practice, minimum viable collaboration with AI is hit the regenerate button 3 or 4 times just to survey the landscape of possibilities, because these are non-deterministic models. And unlike, say, a Google search query, for example, where the user's expectation, and we have been programmed by technology, by the way, not only have we been programming technology, technology's been programming us to expect that the first result is the best result. And with generative AI, it's just not true. And because it's a non-deterministic model, every single regeneration is a different result. And you're basically, you're increasing the search radius by hitting regenerate. So at the very least, you should hit that button. But F-I-X-I-T gives your team a robust framework for making sure that you're not leaving a lot of potential on the table when you leverage generative AI.
So we have a tool called generative AI. So stepping out of this for a second, right? I'm looking at my iPhone. I think it's an iPhone 12 or iPhone 13, which probably has more processing power than NASA had when they sent a man to the moon in 1969. I'm guessing 98% of the world uses their very expensive phones to take selfies on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And they don't use it to its full potential. Mm-hmm. Would we not be asking too much of the world to try to make the most of generative AI when the world doesn't work that way?
No, I mean, it's a great question. Very few people actually want to live to their potential. I mean, there's an aspirational goal, right? Who wants to achieve their potential? Everybody says, I do. Who feels like they're achieving their potential? Everybody says, I don't. And you go, whoa, look at this gap. But the truth is, most people watch Netflix. No offense to Netflix, by the way. Most people are just doom scrolling, right? And if you go, well, what's holding you back? It's not that the tool's available to you. It's fundamentally a question of personal interest and passion. And that's why I actually start with care. I often have said in the context of innovation, if you don't care, don't bother. Yes. Meaning there's all sorts of amazing tools around ideation and prototyping and user testing and all sorts of stuff like that, that I can teach you. But if you don't care about the problem we're trying to solve, then don't bother using any of them. They're not going to avail. And ChatGPT and generative AI is the same exact way. Choose your LLM of choice. There's incredible potential. The real challenge is, to what end am I directing that potential? And that's why I actually start with a lot of people by saying, what's an emotional decision you're trying to make? Most people, when they think of Gen AI, they think in terms of technology, they think in terms of work. Yes. And honestly, for a lot of people, that triggers apathy. No wonder generative AI is not helpful as a co-pilot, because they're not going anywhere. They don't even want to go anywhere. They're clocking in and out, right? But when you start from the premise of, what's an emotional decision you're trying to make? You know, I was talking to a colleague this weekend, and he said, well, I'm going to visit my aging relative who's in hospice care. And it's the first time I've gone back home in quite a while. And I'm really struggling with, how do I maximize the time with this relative, but also try to make time to see friends back home while I'm home, because I'm rarely there. And we had this profoundly transformative conversation, him and me and ChatGPT, where I had ChatGPT interview him about what does it mean for the visit to be productive and fruitful, and tell us more about your relationship with your relative, and tell us more about your friends, and tell us more about how you define a life well lived. And we got to the point through a series of kind of iterative conversation where, you know, I could see my friend was leaning in when ChatGPT, yeah. One of the things it recommended was he should have a daily journaling practice. Now, you and I think anybody who hears that immediately goes, oh yeah, of course. But here's the thing, none of us, when we thought about this friend going to visit a dying relative, were we all thinking, you know what, I want to recommend that he undertake a daily journaling practice, right? It's not on our radar because we have so much information, but he leaned in and I just said to ChatGPT, hey, I think that my friend may be interested in a daily journaling practice. Could you provide a simple acrostic that's memorable that he could leverage at the end of each day to make sure that he doesn't miss any of the human meaning from this trip? Yeah. And all instantaneously, ChatGPT generated a mnemonic device that's a great framework for journaling for this trip. It's totally customized. Is it his idea? Is it my idea? Is it ChatGPT's idea? It doesn't really matter. What matters is this is a profoundly important thing to this friend. And in a 10-minute long conversation standing outside at the park with only voice, you know, technology enabled with ChatGPT, he had a tangible daily practice that he could leverage to turbocharge this visit back home.
So what you're saying here is that ChatGPT or generative AI is a tool. And like any tool, if you have the wrong purpose or if you lack purpose, or if you see it as just something that your boss is telling you to use, you're going to attach that apathy that you attach to work to generative AI, and you're going to approach it the same way you approach doing your expenses at the end of the
month. And you know the bummer, honestly, the huge bummer here is generative AI will perform to your level of expectation.
Oh, I like that.
Which is to say, I know leading edge users who tell me, I've got a podcast called Beyond the Prompt, which is all about AI and business. And many of my guests have told me AI makes them giggle daily, meaning they're so delighted at a display of intelligence and inventiveness that they just can't help but giggle. And they're after that sense of giggling every day, right? For them, AI is a transformative technology it's given them an Iron Man suit, so to speak, in terms of augmenting their natural capability. Then I know people who go, yeah, I tried it once and it really wasn't that good. And what I say is, it has everything to do with what you expect of it. People who expect generative AI to be no good, it will be no good for. And it has nothing to do with the technology. It has everything to do with the expectations of the human collaborator side of the equation.
It actually reminds me of a dinner I once observed between what I'm guessing is a husband and wife. And they were on their phones the entire time and not talking to each other. So if you ask nothing of generative AI, you're going to get nothing in response. If you ask something so closed-ended, you're going to get something closed-ended in response. It's about how you engage it, right?
That's exactly right. I would even go so far as to challenge someone. If you are getting an undesirable or a dissatisfactory output, take responsibility for it and say, it's because I provided insufficient input. And if you'll take that burden upon yourself, simple thing you can do, take an area of your expertise. So for me, my area of expertise is in this kind of design thinking, entrepreneurship, innovation realm, right? So anything related to customer insights or brainstorming or prototyping or early stage testing, et cetera, that sort of stuff, collaboration, right? So I might say, hey, take an area of my expertise, say interdisciplinary collaboration, and ask ChatGPT, what would you recommend a team do in order to leverage diverse expertise? It's going to give me a mediocre answer. I mean, it's been trained on the corpus of the internet, basically. And it's not exactly average, because if it were average, it would have a lot of spelling errors and stuff like that. But you can call it, it's close to average as far as the average sentiments of the internet, right? It's going to give me a mediocre response. And as an expert, here's the thing, what do I do? And if I say, doesn't know that much, and I set it down, I'm the loser. If instead what I do is say, critique the response, and actually go back into ChatGPT, for example, and say, you know what, I think you're failing to account for this dynamic. I think you're failing to account for the fact that homogenous teams actually have a higher degree of trust and they're able to move more quickly and or whatever, right? I mean, you brainstorm or we can make this up. But the point is, I could quickly critique the mediocre response to a query about my expertise because I'm uniquely qualified to do it. And yeah. Then if I ask the LLM to rerun its analysis, given the critique I've just input, you'll be astounded at the kind of output that you get, right? And the point is, it's this iterative conversation. I like that. It's where you go back and forth. And if you wonder what GPT needs in order to give a good response, ask it. That's the amazing thing. That's where this is so different than other technologies that have come before. Say, for example, you may have heard of custom instructions, right? You can basically tell an LLM how to interact with you. Those are called custom instructions. Well, it's pretty cool technology. You can get wildly different answers based on how you instruct an LLM to interact with you. Some people hear about custom instructions and go, I don't even know where to start. Well, the beauty of an LLM is you can go to the LLM and say, I'd love to craft custom instructions to make my interactions with you more enriching or more enjoyable or more productive. Define your own parameters. But I have no idea how to begin. Would you interview me as a New York Times reporter whose job is to craft custom instructions for professional users? Ask me up to 10 questions about myself and my communication style, and then take a first pass at crafting the custom instructions that I could copy paste into ChatGPT. You'll be amazed, right? Which is to say, we can turn the tables on AI. Mm. And all of a sudden, we don't have to know everything. We can, in fact, admit we don't know and leverage its immense and vast knowledge to complement the things that we don't know.
Given America's high divorce rates and how bad we are at relationships, we have to train people how to have a relationship with AI.
Mm. Yeah.
So yeah. What you said is very interesting to me, because I was thinking about this for a while. Because I used to be a senior partner in corporate strategy and often meet clients who always knew more about their businesses than me, obviously. Mm-hmm. A client knows more about their business than I do. But they'd ask me to critique their thinking, and I would then be able to give them insights they had never seen before.
Yeah.
But if they ask me what to do in the first 5 minutes, I often won't know what to do.
Yeah.
So that's the way you're asking us to use generative AI. We are the experts, but can you find different ways of thinking, loopholes, flaws? Can you stress test our thinking? I like that way of using it, because then you're not hoping it for it to be the oracle that's going to give you the answer.
Right. You know, I had a once in a lifetime experience the other day. I was privileged to be invited to a pro basketball game. I advise leaders in different organizations, and one of them was a general manager of a basketball team who has spent a lot of years studying LeBron James as a professional. And one thing that the team happened to be playing LeBron, who plays for the Lakers now, and I was sitting next to the GM during the game, and he was kind of giving me a play-by-play of how LeBron is approaching the matchups. It was a front row, you know, first class graduate level education over the course of an afternoon. He started telling me about how LeBron has a vast amount of knowledge of the game, but it's not until the game unfolds before him that he knows what of that knowledge to tap into. And I think it's actually a really good metaphor for an LLM. It has a vast amount of knowledge, but it doesn't know what of that knowledge to tap into until the quote unquote game unfolds, or until you as its collaborator start to provide information. So this individual, for example, LeBron was in the post and LeBron took a dribble. And what the general manager told me is, based on his knowledge of the game, he's watching the restricted area, which is a part of the court where someone's not allowed to stand for more than 3 seconds. He's watching the restricted area to see if anyone enters. If no one enters, he's going to take another dribble. If someone enters, he's going to pass. Okay. Nobody entered. He took another dribble, and he said, now he's watching the restricted area. And if the weak side defender doesn't collapse, he's going to turn and drive to the bucket, because he knows that no one can get to him until he's at the rim, at which point it's too late to contest it. But here's the thing. If you ask LeBron at the beginning of the game, what's going to happen in the third quarter? He'd say, we're going to play basketball, right? And I think right now, right, he's not going to say, well, after my second dribble, if they don't show up, he's not going to give you all that information. Not that he doesn't know it, but he lacks the context. The game has not unfolded. I think similarly, an LLM, some people say to an LLM, what's going to happen in the third quarter? And it gives this kind of vanilla response like, we're going to play basketball. And they go, that's not insightful. Well, they haven't allowed the game to unfold. And just like LeBron, every dribble, he's watching the dynamics of the defense. In this metaphor, you, human collaborator, are the defense. And you are your responses and reactions and critiques and double downs and, you know, regenerates, you know, all of that is the game unfolding for the LLM. And if you want to tap into this vast kind of LeBron-esque sweeping knowledge of information, you have to be a part of the process.
I must say, it's very brave from someone from San Francisco to use LeBron James as an example. You better have some security when you leave your house.
I'm nothing if not brave. I mean, I am a student of sport. And so I think, I mean, separately, by the way, one thing I've said for years is professional athletes spend an inordinate amount of time practicing.
Yeah.
It's something I really admire, right? They perform, if you think about the percentage of their time that they're actually performing, it's very small, maybe 10%, 5% even. If you think about professionals in any other arena, in your mind, think about strategy professionals. How much of their time do they spend practicing?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
It's a complete criticism I have of people in the field. Once they finish their MBA, they think they need to stop practicing.
And that's a tragedy. And I would say, if you think about your collaboration with generative AI is an area in need of practice, you're well suited. You know, one of the things that my research partner and some partners in my lab have done is we've built what we call AI Drill Coach. And we built it for an NBA team. So we call it the Drill Coach. When the DoD wants to use it, we call it Drill Sergeant, right? So we're indifferent to the kind of branding. But the point is, each day, the coach gives an individual user via Slack or Teams or whatever platform the company is on, gives them a daily LLM drill. Today, you're going to ask an LLM to critique an idea. Here's help text that you can copy paste into an LLM. Hey, I've got this idea. And then describe your idea. I think it's great because, say why you think it's great. Could you poke some holes in my thinking? Help me understand what I'm missing, right? And the coach every day gives a drill like that, just so a human being has a chance to explore the possibilities of the technology. And what we're seeing is, for most users, they're experiencing a 10x improvement or confidence in their ability to converse with AI in 10 days. It's just like 10 minutes a day, but it's taking that practice mindset and saying, if I exert a little bit of effort in learning and in practice, I experience disproportionate impact everywhere else.
I like that. Let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about data security, right? One of the big issues we've seen, and one of the reasons we don't allow AI in our business, is that we don't know how much of our confidential material will be used to train some other system. Now, I've seen that with other companies as well, especially consulting firms, investment banks, and so on, whereby the tension they have is, how do we get our employees to use AI, but how do we guide them in terms of how to use AI in terms of securing information and data and so on? What has been the best practices you have seen in managing that obvious tension that companies are managing right now?
Well, I think data concerns are real and greatly exaggerated. I think that companies tend to be concerned about what's not actually a problem and tend to not be concerned about what actually is a problem. So, for example, some of the predominant use cases involve customer-facing interactions, which actually are some of the highest risk, right? Yeah. Other times where there's not actually a lot of risk, you know, for example, with privacy, no one suspects Dropbox of having access to all of their proprietary information. And yet it does.
Right? And it does, yes.
Because they have contracts in place that specify how data can be used and not be used. And for whatever reason, I think organizations are paranoid, perhaps because of, you know, some old examples, like, you know, from Samsung that have actually been disproven, that aren't even true. There's almost these apocryphal examples of organizations' data being, it's the equivalent of like modern day techno old wives tales that are now limiting organizations' ability to experiment. And I think any organization that is restricting access is only inviting employees to bring private devices. Either you're going to say, here, fight our competition with one arm tied behind your back and, you know, one eye blindfolded, Or you're basically tempting people to work around the draconian measures you've installed in the business. I don't see any way around this. I can't imagine a radiologist that I go to saying, don't worry, only human beings are examining your scans. I go, I want a new radiologist. I'm going to a different practice. You mean to tell me you're not leveraging every technology that's available to you to identify potential cancer? And yet businesses are telling their clients, don't worry, we're not using the best technology available to solve your problems. It's like, at some point, that kind of statement is only going to be a liability. It's not going to be an asset. It's certainly not going to be credibility building. So I think we're in a little bit of a weird kind of in-between state where it's still seemingly plausible for an organization to believe, delusional as it may be, but believe that their, you know, data is a real concern. I mean, then that being said, so that's kind of, that's a bit strongly stated. I think it's all true. At the very least, you could say, folks, don't put customer information in an LLM. Make sure that you have data training turned off on your device, right? There are very simple kind of hygiene practices that make all of these data concerns largely a non-issue. I think right now, I mean, to kind of go to my innovation experience prior to ChatGPT. I mean, I wrote the book Idea Flow. It came out 1 month and 5 days before ChatGPT was released, right? Which is to say, I wrote the world's best book on, or co-wrote the world's best book on idea generation a month prior to the best tool for idea generation was released in the world. It's like saying you write the best book on retail 1 month prior to the internet. It's like things change, right? And so I'd spent a ton of time, you know, a dozen plus years leading innovation capacity building organizations, endeavors inside of organizations. And one of the things that I saw, I mean, just by way of analog, I would see teams routinely say, the reason that we can't test this new feature is because legal won't let us, for example.
Yes, that's right.
And so they wouldn't pilot new, you know, potentially market shifting technologies because, quote unquote, legal won't let us. Well, I fell for that a couple of times early in my kind of teaching journey. And then one day it dawned on me, it has nothing to do with legal. These people are afraid to try something new and they need a good reason. And it doesn't sound professional or credible or brave to say, I'm scared. And so instead of saying, I'm scared, they say, compliance slapped my wrist, right? And I think there's something like that now. Instead of organizations saying, there's no instruction manual. What do we, you mean our junior employees may be better than our senior employees? You mean that we're democratizing access? You mean to tell me that Bloomberg spends $10 million on Bloomberg GPT and it gets outperformed by a publicly available model that anyone in 169 countries can use? Yes. And because that is scary, they go, you know what, let's clamp down. And I which is to say, I've seen this show before. It's not surprising to me that organizations or individuals are intimidated or scared, but it doesn't, just like the team that wouldn't, you know, reach out to a customer because they're scared, but they said it's because of compliance. Just like that team's challenge was not compliance, I believe most organizations' challenge is not data privacy. It's become the quote unquote good reason to justify, you know, intimidation and the unknown and things like that.
I think the question is a little bit different. It's not saying that generative AI is bad. I'm saying it's good. It's going to change the world. The question is, whom do you trust with your data?
Yeah.
That's a different question. I agree. It's going to change the world. You need to build the capability. You have to have the ability to embed it within your workflow and work processes. But the question becomes, whom do you trust? And obviously not all actors are trustworthy.
Yeah, I mean, there, I have seen a lot of organizations kind of default to the Microsoft ecosystems. It's a walled garden, it's protected. And I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of different perspectives about that. If you're kind of inclined to Elon Musk's perspective, he wanted OpenAI to be open because of Google, and you know, and now all of a sudden, actually, it's Microsoft. He didn't want any one organization to kind of have a dominant position. They thought at the time it was going to be Google with DeepMind. Turns out now it's Microsoft, which I don't think he's any happier about. It's still not open, right? But the point is, if you want kind of proprietary systems, you can. That's imminently doable right now, you know. And do you trust Microsoft? I mean, they control all of your email, right? They control all of your files. They have access to almost every. So I don't see a concern about who can we trust with our data. You can have access to frontier models even via, you know, Microsoft Copilot 365 right now, right? And so even if you are the most conservative that you can be, I think there are still systems that you can be leveraging to unleash potential and unleash employees. Even there, though, I'm seeing a lot of folks tread exceptionally cautiously rather than embrace experimentation, try pilot, prototype, et cetera, which you and I know are that's the seeds of innovation is actually through experimentation. And right now, experimentation is being kind of strangled in the name of good governance. And I think that folks are going to look back on this season and wish that they had been more adventurous, perhaps, or at least more bold in the kinds of experiments they were commissioning.
It's like any new technology, you know, how much do you go in, all in, how far do you go? How do you manage the transition? There's going to be mistakes. You have to manage data somehow, but the question is, how do you do it in a way that doesn't put you behind your competition?
Yeah, I think right now the barriers have never been lower. You know, if I were a startup, I'd be going after slow, you know, highly bureaucratic incumbents all over the place, because the speed with which you're able to compete and pivot and iterate and learn, you know, the speed of an organization's learning is a function of the speed of their experimentation.
Let's build on that. If you were running a startup, where would you go now? How would you use AI right now?
I would not be building, you know, GPT wrappers. I would be looking for more for foundational opportunities where leveraging AI could offer significant advantages that an incumbent may not be able to see. I'm not, that's not my world, or that's not my role. That's not my life, but I would be trying to do something more deeply involved in an industry than just simply a GPT wrapper.
What about the GPT wrapper for our audience?
Oh, it basically is taking a very simple kind of function that could be performed even with publicly available software,
yes,
and just wrapping it so that it's maybe it's private, maybe it's a private instance of that application, but it's not doing anything more than anybody almost off the street could do with tools that are off the shelf.
Okay. So if an organization was going to be rolling out the use of generative AI within their organization, what would be sort of the rule of thumb to make sure that the employees used it effectively? What are the top three things? If I was going to roll this out to my team tomorrow morning, got them onto a Zoom call, how do I get them to think about this differently so that they don't just type in, hope for the answer, and then say, Michael, this is terrible, I'm not going to use it?
I mean, first thing is, you've got to be using the best models. So friends, don't let friends use, you know, GPT 3.5, for example. Two, you've got to get a minimum of 10 hours. If you haven't spent 10 hours in the next month, you're fired, right? It's like go to that extreme, I would actually recommend, right? Which is not to, I mean, I'm not saying you should actually fire people, but think in terms of how do we punish not using rather than reward using? It's just totally flipped a paradigm. So minimum of 10 hours. I would be creating channels where folks can share experiments and learnings and hacks and tricks. So I would be, you know, creating those communication channels. I'd be celebrating AI. I realize you asked for three, now I'm on four. I'd be celebrating AI wins. So anytime I hear of someone doing something interesting, it's publicly rewarding, publicly celebrating, publicly holding them up. And then the fifth thing I would do is I would be a lead user myself in the context of an organization. I would be prepared to be totally honest, and not just honest, but celebratory and brag about how I'm using AI to turbocharge my own work. So I'll give you an example. I was talking just yesterday. I spent a lot of time with organizations, leadership teams, helping them think about strategically identifying opportunities to leverage AI. One of the leaders I was talking to of a you know, multinational beverage company, let's put it that way, said he's got, he has hundreds of folks who roll up to him, all of whom he's got to read their 360 evaluations.
Yeah.
Not a surprise to learn that he has now uploaded 360 evaluations to GPT and asked GPT to help synthesize some of that information. It saved him an enormous amount of time. And then he uses GPT to help write his synthesis and review back to the person. But then he also outsource is the wrong word. He also externalized his own process to everyone in the organization to show how they too could leverage GPT to synthesize 360 reviews for the folks who are underneath them and synthesize their reviews of people, right? So it's not like he's doing it quietly and not telling anybody. It's no, this is a superpower for me. It's saving me a lot of time, and I want to be saving other people time as well. So that fifth thing, I think, finding ways to use GPT yourself. I'll give you another example. A CEO that I know who's on my podcast, he told me he was curious to know how much of his board feedback he could replicate via LLM. So he took the last board deck that he had presented to the board for the quarter before, he fed it into Claude and GPT-4 and a couple of others. And he said, you're a board member of this company, and you have been given this pre-read. What are your top three concerns and the top three questions or recommendations you're going to make in the upcoming board meeting? He said that some of the LLMs, he had his team take diligent notes during the board meeting and then compare them with the LLM's output. Claude, I think, and this is before Claude 3, by the way, Claude 2 had 91% overlap with his board of directors. I'll give you another example. I mean, let's come back to that story in a second. I mean, this CEO told his whole company, he shared it as a case study. Even I, for my most important, like, think of something more important to the CEO than presenting to his board. Even that, I'm finding ways to bring generative AI into my role and responsibilities. Yeah. That is incredible unleashing power to the organization. Set aside what you think about that. His organization is all looking at him going, if he's doing it, I better find ways to use it, right? But going back to the question of how we talk about these things, you know, I had a session last week with a big ed tech company, and one of the, everybody in this session, there's about 10 senior leaders who are working to develop kind of proposals for AI initiatives. And they're going to write up a proposal, send it to the general manager who's in charge of this, you know, billion-dollar business unit. At the end of the session, I said, hey, Mitch, would you like to say a few words about like the process, what's going to unfold from here? And he and I had talked about it. He's basically going to read the memos, and then he's going to make some resourcing decisions to play some bets, that are calculated and thoughtful, but still, they're not guaranteed. So I hand the floor to Mitch, and he goes, hey, folks, I'm excited to read your memos. You got till Monday to turn them in. Just so you know, I will be reading these. I'm not going to have ChatGPT read them. I'm going to read them myself. And then, and before you even finish, I said, Mitch, hang on, respectfully, why would you say that? Why would you say that you're not? I think what you mean to say is, certainly I'm going to read your memos, and I'm going to leverage every single tool available to me to make sure that I'm combating my own bias and dispositions and favoritism to make sure that the best projects get resourced. Isn't that what you mean to say? And he said, yeah, you're right. Absolutely. I was almost embarrassed to think of using GPT, but I should. Actually, folks, I'm going to make sure, right? But the point is, it sounds responsible, right? To say, I'm going to read them myself. But the problem is, it plants a suspicion in everybody's mind. There are some things that it's cheating to use this with, right?
Yes.
I realize you were joking, but just like to use it as like a poignant moment, the fact that our instinct is, wow, if an LLM overlaps the board, that board must be not worth their salt. It's like, I don't know. I don't know that that's true. I think actually, it turns out LLMs have vast capabilities. And what this CEO has done is because he's on a number of boards himself. And he said, now I'm taking board decks that I get, And I'm feeding him into LLM so that I can up my game. So now all of a sudden, instead of spending 5 hours to prepare questions that an LLM could ask, I have the LLM prepare them, and then I'm making next order thinking and I'm building on those ideas. And so it's actually making him a much better board member. And the point isn't who's going to get fired or anything like that. It's how do we all up our game? And I think there's one way to think about the world with generative AI, which is how many less people can we eke the same performance out of, right? Which is like a scarcity mindset. It's an efficiency orientation, which is fine, efficiency gains, whatever. But then there's a totally different perspective, which is how much more could we accomplish with our people now that they have these turbocharged abilities, right? And that to me, that's more about abundance. That's more about possibility. And I'm in that latter camp. I'm not looking to, you know, to get rid of people or to squeeze more work out of fewer people. I'm looking to accomplish greater things, recognizing, wow, just like now everybody's got computers and all of a sudden we have word processors. None of us are worrying about how to spell onomatopoeia or whatever, right? We have these tools that are available to us that have the potential to turbocharge all of our respective contributions. Why in the world would we not be exploring the edges of possibility?
I have a follow-up question. It's a small question, but it's an important one. But I also have an observation. I have a friend who is the head of digital at a major consulting firm. And obviously follow him on LinkedIn and so on. And one thing I've noticed about him is that when generative AI took off with ChatGPT, all he ever posted about was how he uses AI to do his work. That's all he ever talked about. And it reminded me of something you said. He destigmatized the use of AI very quickly. When someone as senior as him, he's a senior guy, talks to CEOs all the time, and he's talking about how he's using AI to improve his reasoning, stress test his thinking, to make sure his logic makes sense and so on. And it reminded me of what you said, whereby leaders or anyone needs to take the role of showing that they are using it, talking about the successes and the failures as well. I mean, he's quite open about this doesn't work as well. This is how I modified it. This is how I checked it and so on. But he made it part of his life. And I'm trying to think back, has he ever posted anything that was not AI related in the last few months? I can't think of anything. That's all he ever talks about. And he made it normal within his company. I think that's a good example of what you were talking about.
Yeah, and the reality is folks give attention to that. Leaders cast an enormous shadow. And if as a leader, you are forthright about your own experiments and your own interest, and you're gonna call folks out of the corners of the organization who are similarly experimental. And yeah, I don't think it's the task to try to convert everyone, but I think a kind of key metric that leaders should be paying attention to is what percent of our team is comfortable, what percent of our team is confident in their ability to leverage these tools. That's what we're doing with this. You know, coach, this drill coach, for example, is we're trying to increase the sense of confidence. Because right now, if you believe the research, you know, from Ernst & Young and so forth, the predominant emotion most folks feel when AI gets mentioned is fear. And what we're trying to do is let's move people from fear to familiar to fluent to we're having fun. And the lead users that I'm talking to are having fun. They're going, I can't believe it does this. You know, I want more and more people to have that experience. So they go, no way it could do that. That's where we're going to start to find the fringes of possibility if we can get people kind of on that journey.
So I want to go back to the example of the board member, right? It's a very technical question. It's a very minor question. When he's submitting that document into whatever LLM he's using, how is he ensuring it's not shared publicly? Is there some kind of setting he's using or something?
Yeah, of course. You can just say, you know, don't use my chat history for training purposes. That's very simple.
Okay. And most people know this, right?
I don't know. I mean, the fact that
that's a big deal.
The fear continues to persist. I feel perhaps people aren't aware of it, but it's a simple setting. It's just a toggle. Okay. Just like you can go into incognito mode, right? It's that simple.
It's a very important thing because everyone listening to this is going to be thinking, how do I use AI to protect my data? And I want to make sure that they understand there's a setting. You can set it on or off to train the LLM or not train the LLM and keep your data secure.
And the thing that I would say is, again, we've been talking a lot about technology, work, etc. Start personal. What's an emotional decision you're trying to make right now? Go have a conversation with an LLM about it. Ask the LLM to ask you questions about how you're thinking and your values. And watch as you go, oh, wow. It's going to cause you to lean in. It's going to cause you to wonder. It's going to cause you to. And then you'll find, I mean, this happened with a relative of mine over the holidays. She was asking me about these technologies. And I said, oh, let's play through a real situation. What's on your mind? And she talked through a very personal issue with me and ChatGPT. And what was fascinating was the rest of the week, you know, she's in the kitchen going, hey, do you think ChatGPT could help me find a substitute for cream of mushroom soup in the green bean casserole recipe? Because we're out. I go, yeah. Hey, do you think ChatGPT could help us with our family photos? We're about to have a photographer show up and I don't know what the right setup is. Yeah, right? And on, which is to say all of a sudden, this person's imagination was stimulated about possibilities after they had had a personal kind of epiphany about the way interactions work, right? A lot of people are finding they're drawing a blank when it comes to work because they've never had a personal experience. And so I find if folks start personal, then their imagination starts to be sparked with possibility when it comes to the workplace.
So what you're saying is start with things that excite you.
Start with things you care about. Yeah. And sometimes it's as simple as, you know, this has been like kind of gnawing at me. Like just, you know, I mean, one of the most amazing features of, for example, ChatGPT's application is you can go into voice mode. You know, and I feel like, you know, we talk about natural language processing. Yeah. None of us, our natural language is through our thumbs, you know, or through our fingers. We're verbal processors. This is the primary means by which we communicated. None of us, we aren't thinking in terms of being perfect or having perfect syntax or anything like that. Well, to be able to interact with an LLM with your voice is a totally different experience. And so going to voice and just, you know, another simple thing that I've recommended people do, which is super helpful, is finish a call or finish a task, or when you're driving home or when you're on the way somewhere, like for me, sometimes I'll do this when I'm stretching, open ChatGPT and just do a verbal vomit. Hey, I've been thinking about this, or a couple things are still on my mind is, and I know I need to do this, and I've got to, you know, and just kind of just verbal vomit. And then at the end say, would you kind of organize all those thoughts and give me a quick memo that I could read after my drive home is over, after I finish stretching, so that I can remember all the stuff that's on my mind, you know? And you go, wow, that was actually really good.
And I'm gonna try that. I like that idea.
These are simple drills that if you do them, you start to go, it just starts expanding the possibility space of ways you can use it and ways that it can find itself available to you. And that's the onus or the responsibility that we all need to take upon ourselves is, where can I go to be sparking my imagination? You know, I would say to you, if you're a listener, it's like, what podcast am I listening to? What newsletters am I reading? What are the venues or avenues or channels for sharing information in my company, outside of my company, right? Just think about that, because your imagination is a function of your experience. It sounds like a kind of a blanket statement, but it's true. We can only imagine that which we've experienced or seen, or, you know, some kind of cognitive input. When it comes to AI and the question of how do we stimulate our imaginations in regards to AI? Well, what's your input? Let me see your diet. I'll tell you how your health's going to be, right? Show me what you're inputting. Show me what you're listening to, what you're reading, what you're trying, who you're sharing with, who you're being shared with by. I can predict with a high degree of confidence what kind of output to expect. And so just taking that kind of learning is similar to a practice posture, taking a learning posture. I think will be, people will start hearing something going, wait, could I? Yes. The moment you think, could I? Just like, and then that little ... stop the podcast, stop reading the newsletter, whatever, and then try it right then. That's the thing, is to shift from I've learned something to I'm going to try it. And if you'll start operationalizing that routine, you'll find it becomes more and more natural.
I like that. It's a very good way to think about it. It's almost as if, think of generative AI as an always on companion. that you can always reach out to, no matter what's going on. If it is at 3 a.m. in the morning, you want to test something and think about it, there is someone there who is going to be a sounding board.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, and unlike, you know, with your friends, you can't call them in the middle of the night, but with ChatGPT, instantly available. And
you can call them. They may not answer. That's
the only thing. Yeah.
Jeremy, thank you so much. I actually found that to be a very, very necessary conversation, I think.
Because
in all the talk with AI, we always focus on the capability, but not on the behavioral modifications we need to make the most of it.
We've talked a lot about prompt engineering. I think what's required here is a little bit of human engineering.
Oh, I like that. Let's re-engineer some humans.
Yeah.
Congress is going to be all over us. Jeremy, thank you so much. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I mean, I would love to hear from folks that are trying these things. To me, it's really fun. You hear about love languages. What's your love language? My love language is stories. So if anybody hears anything here and they have an experience or a question, I love getting stories. I'm available on LinkedIn, Twitter. You know, you can go to my website, jeremyutley.design. Yes. You can go to howtofixit.ai. And I'm happy to share whatever information I can, whatever drills I've learned through kind of hard won trial and error myself. I am eager. My personal goal, I'll end with this. My personal goal is to help spark 100,000 conversational epiphanies in others. And so I don't even know how to count that, by the way, but if you have an epiphany or if you feel like there's an epiphany coming on, let me know and I'll just put a mark. I'm just keeping a tally on my wall here.
I can see all the pins up on your wall there. I think it'll be a good idea to have you back in about a year when we see what's happened with AI, how people are using it, get some feedback from our listeners and our clients as well. Because things are moving rapidly. It would be great to see how much AI is changing human behavior and vice versa. And what's going on next. Thank you, Jeremy. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
As we wrap up, today's podcast is sponsored by strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies as a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you're looking to advance your career and need to update your resume, you can get a McKinsey and BCG winning resume template example as a free download at www.firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF.